were talking about the Stimson Lumber Mill, and you were talking about the seasonal nature of employment down there, where a lot of the men around here work in the mill then, local men?
Oh, yes. To start with, they had all the local men they could get, you know. I was one. Then they had a strike in 35. I didn't go back. I found other work instead of going back there.
They had a strike, you said?
Lumber strike. Oh, yeah, all over the West Coast in 35, the big lumber strike. Yeah.
What was that, anyway? What was that about?
Well, they wanted more money. That was in the days of REA wages. The government had set the wage at $3.40 a day for common labor, something like that. Yeah. They thought it was time to have more money, which was right.
The loggers thought it was time to have more money, you're saying?
Yeah, all the lumber industry was closed down for the big strike in 1935. Yeah. He didn't turn the wheel.
Who organized that strike? What was that?
Well, it was the AF of L was behind it, you know. Then a few years later, they came up with the CIO committee. Committee of Industrial, I've forgotten that one. I guess it was Committee for Industrial Organization, wasn't it?
Mm-hmm. So none of the workers went back to work for Stimson Lumber Mill?
Yeah. Well, you know, the working men were kind of divided. One man would work for Stimson, and another one would say, let them do their own work. Yes, a fellow who worked for a part-time employer, he was really out of luck. Now, when he went to draw his unemployment insurance, he was a seasonal worker and he didn't get any unemployment insurance. If he did, it was very little. And the Social Security, that's the bad thing. They were getting less money by quite a bit because he was a seasonal worker. I've forgotten how much difference it was between my unemployment money and a man I know who worked for Stimson, but it was certainly a worthwhile difference. Say, for instance, he was getting $100 Social Security checks, while I would be getting $150. That's quite a difference in a working man's pocket.
Was it because of the weather, winter weather, that they only worked part-time?
That's what they claimed, yeah. That was the reason. There must have been a number of other places on the West Coast here that were only seasonal workers, too. Now, down Snow Peak out of Albany, I never was down there, but there was lots of snow down that country, too. They were just seasonal workers.
We're talking about the snow. What are winters like up here in these hills?
In 69, we had a deep snow. Did all over the country here. right in my backyard, I measured, I think it was 37 inches, yeah, right in my backyard, 30 inches of snow in 1969. That'd be about the 1st of February, 69.
Having that much snow, it's quite hard to get around. Was there any big snowstorms back in the teens and the 20s?
Oh, yeah, way back. I think it was the spring of 1916. We'll say February. We had deep snow that time, you know, around 30 inches, something like that. And in 1950, we had a dandy that hung on a long time. Our power line was out, I believe, 13 days that time. The power lines were out all around the area, you know. We might have got them up here sooner, but it's more important to those fellows who were depending on electricity for their milking machines, and a lot of them had to pump water. They were just out of luck.
That snowstorm back in 1916, it must have been impossible to get around or leave the farm then.
Oh, with horses in those days. You could go almost anywhere with horses that was in snow. Unless it was had been rained on, was badly crusted, you know, then a horse would kind of skin up his shins walking in the crusted snow. I don't know how bad that was. Yes, I remember going to Gaston in the early spring of 16, I think is right. Yeah, that's right. With a team and a sled. All the way to Gaston. It was cold and snowing. And the neighbor who lived down in Scoggin Valley came out and hollered at me. He always smoked cigars. He was kind of rated as the king of Scoggin Valley, one of the bigger farmers down there. And he always had to have the Valinda cigar. And bring me a package of Valinda cigars when you came back. So I did that. Yeah, and as I said, it was freezing, I think, all day that day. The snow was quite old then. And I remember going into Gaston, right near Gaston. The railroad had a snow plow. It went by as I was there. Gaston had electric trains then, I mean, through that end of the SP railroad. And it was electric powered snow plow. It would be a rotary rig, you know, like a big fan inside. It was sucking the gravel and everything, I guess, off the track, you know, and bang, bang, she'd go once in a while, you know, and that would shoot out to the sides. Going through the town of Gaston, they didn't use it. I suppose it would break the windows, the rocks flying out. That was about the only one of those I had ever seen working.
You're talking about this man that was called the King of Scoggin Valley.
Tom Sain.
Can you tell me a little bit more about him? Why was he considered such a...
Well, he was one of the bigger farmers, you know, and had one of the best homes. One time there was a Well, I guess he had been with a missionary party in Africa. And of course, I'll never forget anything that interests a kid about 15 years old, you know, he never will forget that. So this man told about, by the way, they Saints put up all these travelers who came. If a school superintendent had to stay overnight somewhere, why, he stopped at the Saint house, and they kept him and boarded him till he decided to leave. Well, this man also boarded, or that is, stayed overnight with Saints, and he told about his trip up the Zambezi River, I believe I've got it right, the Zambezi River in Africa. And he told how one place where there were camp, there was an old fellow there who walked with an awful bad limp. One knee was in bad shape. And the old fellow told him what had happened. He, in his younger days, the tribe from the hills came down to steal their women. And in the fight that ensued, the old fellow got hit, jabbed with a spear in his leg. And he figured the spearhead was still in there. So there was a doctor in this missionary party, and he talked the old fellow into letting him operate and get that spearhead out of there. And this man, he said he was helping. He held the gauze while they give the old fellow the ether or whatever they give in those days. And he says, I keep wiping the blood away and wiping. And the old doctor shook his head. He figured the old man didn't know what he was talking about, the old cripple, see. And he says, pretty soon the gauze hooked on something. And there was the point of that spear, hooked on that spear. And he says, we got it out of there. And you know, after that healed up, he says, that old fellow would do anything for us. He could walk around better, you know, and he'd bring fowl and anything we wanted to eat. Yep, he certainly did appreciate that.
Tom Saint was quite a storyteller then, of some of his adventures.
Yeah, he, one I guess he didn't like, he and another man in the neighborhood went for a hike. They were going to go up to Saddle Mountain. You can see it on a clear day from here, you know, Two Point, sticking up. They were going up there, and on that trip they got lost. And they wandered around, I think they were gone for 3 or 4 days, the way I remember the story, and they came out down at Tillamook. And those days they told the story that the fellows got so hungry they tried eating some snails they found on the rocks. I don't know, you believe anything, you can't believe anything like that. Well, anyway, I bet he didn't go for a hike in the woods for a while after that.
He started out from here to hike up to Saddle Mountain?
Yeah, he started.
By walking then?
Oh yeah, oh yes.
Boy, that's a long walk, isn't it?
Yeah, sure it was a long walk. It's, well, I guess by section line, you know, as the crow flies, it would only be about 23 miles in a straight line from here over there. But you go wandering around through the woods. That takes a long time. Yep.
Did you ever go over there to Saddle Mountain?
Oh yeah, I've been up there lots of times. Yeah, I went up there. The lookout man up there, the Saddle Mountain lookout for the forestry, you know, I stayed with him about 10 days one time. That was in 32, I guess it was. Yeah, well, that's right, 32. And I built a fireplace there. Somebody saw another forestry man who had a fireplace in his lookout cabin. So I had never built a fireplace before, but I built several chimneys. This one here is one. So the forestry guy, thought I could do it. So I did it. Looked all right, worked all right. And the next year, it all burned down in the 33 fire.
They never replaced that building up there?
No, never was replaced. Oh, yes. It was put on the south peak of the mountain after that, the south peak. The south peak was about 400 feet higher than where they had the lookout originally, you see. 1925, they built this little cabin on the north peak. Then they decided they would have it on the south peak because of 400 feet more elevation, which was where it should have been in the first place.
You mentioned the Tillamook fire. There was several. Could you tell me, did the fire get close to here when you were living around this parts?
No. That fire didn't get, well, it got within about 2 miles as the crow flies, just about 2 miles. Well, you can see up here in this old burn, that's as close as it got.
What was the area like? What were the skies like during the big fires? I mean, you knew they were going on, did you not?
You can do what?
When the fire was blazing, did you go out and help fight the fire?
Or? Oh, yeah. Yes, I was a fire warden those days, camped out on the head of the Tualatin River. And the fire started over on Gales Creek. What was the 15th of August, the 11th of August? In the middle of August. And that was around noontime, I believe it started. Just as you go over the summit of the Wilson River, you know, you've been over the summit of the Wilson River, right? Well, just before you get up to the summit, that's right where the fire started, down in the canyon there, on your right as you go up.
This was the first Tillamook fire?
The Tillamook fire?
Yeah, was this the first one?
That's where it started. Mm-hmm. And that was about, say, around noontime, or 11 o'clock, I guess, in the morning. Anyway, at 11 o'clock that night, the fire was 6 miles away from there, uphill all the way, you know, that 6 miles, kept getting higher and higher elevation all the time. Yep, that was in just 12 hours, it had gone 6 miles.
What was it like fighting that fire?
If you're right up near the fire, within a few feet, or where you could kick it with your feet or something like that, it wasn't very smoky usually because the draft took the smoke right up, you see. But then you get out in a low place, maybe like this would be. The air would bring it around maybe and it'd be awful smoky. Out here where I was camped on the Tualatin there was a man from the office at Stimson's Mill down there. He'd been with him a long time, and he came out to kind of keep books, or I don't know what. There was 200 men out there where I was camped at one time, just for a short time, and they sent him out to do something. Anyway, that place was 1,500 feet elevation, but it was in a kind of a low place there, kind of protected all around from higher country. And it was smoky. Boy, oh boy, it was awful smoky. And this fella, he just couldn't take any more of it. I saw him pick up his belongings, he just grabbed everything together, and he started right down the road. He just walked off.
Was there quite a bit of smoke in this area here, in Scoggins Valley?
Probably. Had an east wind all the time, and the fire was all west of us, let's say. And it held the fire and the smoke that way. to have the...
We were talking about the Tillamook fire here.
Yeah, that's right.
You were saying, talking about the Scoggins Valley, and, well, was there a lot of smoke and debris in the air at that time here in the valley?
Well, as I was saying there, it seemed like in Forest Grove, at the fire patrol headquarters was in Forest Grove at that time, and it seemed like there was a little smoke in the air, but it was coming in with a draft of air all the time. It seemed like the wind must have been bringing it around, because we had a steady east wind all the time, day and night for several days. No, the old-timers who had worked on forest fires before around here had never seen it burn like this fire burned. There was a steady draft of wind all the time, and the trees would crown, you know, big fir trees have lots of moss, usually, and we'd get on the dry bark and moss and go right up, and then one would catch fire, and then the draft from that would go over to another one, and it would go up, and they'd all roar at once. That would be a crown when it goes up that way, a crown fire. It didn't mean that the whole country crowned at one time, but there'd be a spot here would go up, and then another one over here. And at night, it was quite a sight, of course. And once in a while, way off in the distance, you would see a different colored flame. I've forgotten now. It was whiter than the wood or the needles burning. And the fellows would say that would be a bee tree, you know, hollow treetop, you know, the honey in the tree would burn just like gasoline, and it made a different colored light. I think it was white, much lighter color, you know, than either the pitch in the tree or the needle burning. Mm-hmm.
Hmm. Was there a, what was the feeling among the people that when you lived around here, was there a fear that it might burn down the area around in this neighborhood?
Or well,
was there, did people wonder whether it would ever go out? Or
I don't know what the thought was that way, but now, if the fire had started over, say, near Forest Grove, in the cleared land, the wheat fields and all that, then, with that wind going steady, it would have taken away a lot of homes. You can bet on that. Now, like, if there was dry weather and a steady wind, that small timber doesn't make much fire, but it wouldn't hardly crown. That kind of stuff wouldn't hardly, I don't believe it would crown. Anyway, somebody would be a good idea for somebody to be here to put out a fire that started around this house, because it might burn. Like the eaves troughs would be full of leaves, you know, they're bound to be. And a fire would start in there from a spark, maybe. If you want to be here and put it out, you'd be safe if someone is here to watch. But if you run away and leave it, it might catch on fire and burn. Mm-hmm.
We've been talking about the first fire, right? Back in 33, I think, or thereabouts.
Yeah.
How about the following fires, the one in 39 and the one in 45?
In 45, the fire got within, well, as far as you can see over there on the road, you know, 1,000 feet from there. The fire came that close in 45. It didn't do much damage around this part of the country. They, you know, there was a big logging outfit. The Consolidated Logging Camp was going over west of here. They had taken away, well, most of the timber.
What was the feeling like when these two successive fires, one right after the other, was it felt like it was almost a curse in a sense that it was happening again?
Well, I know Miller of the Stimson Lumber Company was out there on the first day that I went out on the fire from where I was over on the head of the Tualatin. Miller was out there going around the fire with me and someone else, and he was crying that Stimson had just started a year or so before that, you know. And I planned on 25 years of operation down here, and here it is all going up in smoke. Well, it was the best thing for Miller that ever happened. Really, they only owned 13 sections of land down here, and then there was lots and lots of timber around they could pick up for their own price, which they did. And the hardboard idea came up, and boy, it didn't hurt them any. It made them the best money there ever was. They couldn't have done better.
This Mr. Miller.
Miller was Harold Miller. He was old Stinson's son-in-law, and this was his project down here. See, yeah, he was the big shot to the Stimson Lumber Company in Scoggin Valley.
What kind of man was he? Was he quite an energetic man? Tough businessman?
Oh, yeah, he was a... He was trying to be either way with the big business or get along with his help.
Did you get to know him personally? Did you meet him very many times?
Well, I was camped out with him a few days, time or two. I remember he liked the eggs fried hard, just like I did when I was a young kid. No, he wasn't. He didn't hardly fit in. That at all. There was a young lad with me and the surveyor that I was working with there, timber cruiser, and they had started the cutting right away, and they didn't have too much experience. Well, there's a bunch of small hemlock trees there, you know, about like that stuff down there, and they had fell the trees this way and that way and every direction, and Miller and this kid were coming out to where me and the surveyor were camped, and they had to walk over these trees that were down, and Miller had a pack sack on his back and the kid had one of his own. He had two for Miller, I don't know which. Anyway, he told me that Miller got on top of something and sticks with his pack sack, and he fell right down in that cribbing in the hole there, and he had to help him out. Maybe that don't sound good on the recording. Well, anyway, that's what happened.
Well, you can imagine him falling down. Do you ever see him anymore? Does he come out?
No, I haven't seen. I haven't seen him since, well, those days. No, I haven't. He'd been out here, yes. He had his picture in the county paper one time. They had some kind of a tree farming get together and advertising for, you know, for their tree growth they had, showing how much a tree would. Some of them, they call that thing the leader, I believe. On the top of a Christmas tree, you know, this little thing goes up like that, and there's a bud on top. It grows that much each year. You can tell the height it grows by that little thing, that leader. And they had in their story, Miller's picture was in there, some of them, they said, went as much as 30 inches. Well, they were picking out the very best ones. I think that would be quite a growth, 30 inches.
All right. We've mentioned Scoggin Valley several times. I was just wondering, how much area does Scoggin Valley include here? Is this?
Well, the area would be just the watershed. Say it comes from the top of that ridge down, going north, and this one here, the top of the high country here, going south, all coming into the creek. Now, for instance, the lake, Hague Lake, is, they estimate there's less than 1,200 acres. Well, most of that land was farming land, you know. And down where Simpson Mill is, that was the most acreage of any farm I believe in Scoggin Valley. That was the old Walker place.
This valley in here must get quite a bit of rain during the year then. Is it a pretty wet climate in here?
Yeah, I've forgotten how much annual rainfall. Boy, oh boy. Haven't we had over 100 inches of rainfall here in 12 months?
Wow, that's a lot
of
rain.
Yeah, yes, that. Over at Val Sets, when I worked over there in 45, 46, the old fellow I worked for, what did he say? The engineers figured there was more waterfall there at Val Sets than there was at Tongue Point. Now, Tongue Point down here below Astoria is supposed to be the wettest spot, I think, in Oregon. Isn't that right? Tongue Point. But the engineers claimed it didn't rain as many days, but it rained harder up at Val Sets than it did at Tongue Point.
Where is Val Sets now?
Val Sets is over, well, you know about the area of Dallas, Oregon, over in Polk County. Dallas is the county seat of Polk County. And Val Sets would be up in the high country there on, we'll say it's right on the head of the Siletz River, which goes down into Siletz Bay down the coast there. Yeah.
How about here in Scoggin Valley? You're saying that this gets a lot of rain in this area, particular locale?
Well, yeah, I suppose like the average spot in the Willamette Valley, about the same, I imagine. Mm-hmm.
Are the headwaters of the Tualatin River here in the valley somewhere? Or are they nearby?
Yeah, that's Scoggins Creek. That's one of the tributaries to the Tualatin River. And that is the main fork. They call it the Tualatin, going up through Cherry Grove. And Gale Creek is another one. Dairy Creek. And then the others coming in, the Rock Creek, the other side of Hillsboro, and McKay Creek. Oh, down south, I've forgotten the names of some of those.
Are those creeks in the beginning of the Twelves River, were they a lot cleaner than they are now? Were they, was it pretty clean water down there?
Well, I suppose so. The fellows working down, I used to work for the, I did work for the county 2.5 years, the county road department. So I got over the some parts of the county I had never seen before, and it was very interesting that I'd been here so long and not seen so much of the county as I did with the road department. And I worked a whole lot down at Durham. They had a big rock crusher there, and I was down there quite a bit of that time, about 2.5 years I worked. And that is down near Tualatin in that country, Tiger Tualatin area. And the water, there's lots of houses down in that country, lots of settlements, you know. Well, Sano Creek, the road boss says, the bridge boss, the bridge carpenter, said there are 13 bridges on Sano Creek. A little sluggish stream runs all around, and people living all up and down there, and the water stuck from those septic tanks, so many septic tanks, you know, soaking into it. And the Tualatin River in near Tigard and Tualatin. I know the rock crusher boss lived over in that area, and he says that there's just a scum when the water is low in the summer. You can see the slime and scum in the on the rocks along the creek banks. And bullfrogs. I had never seen any bullfrogs till I got to working for the county there. And out south of Hillsboro, on a bridge, I'd hear them bullfrogs, just like a hog grunt sounded to me like. I had never seen them before. And you look steady down there and you see his eyes sticking right up out of the water. And one day, me and another fellow were down there painting a bridge, and some kids came along with the, first I thought they were fish, but they had bullfrogs. A bunch of bullfrogs on a string, and the sun had dried their skins. They looked awful. They were taking them home, I guess. I didn't have any appetite for them, I don't think.
The headwaters up here on the Tualatin have always been really clean then, I would imagine.
Oh yeah. Yeah, that's pure clean water. No filth soaking into it up here.
Along with the headwaters up here, this area has pretty much been untouched scenic area. Do you see it changing at all with the advent of Peg Lake and families and people moving in this area?
Oh, I wouldn't know anything about that water pollution, contamination. I wouldn't know anything about that.
Well, how about just the general area? Do you think this area will be becoming developed? Developed more and more?
Yes, gradually. Gradually, every place there will be room for a home, there will be a home site. It's a home site, I mean, there will be a home. Yeah. The people living down here, as you came up the hill, McIntosh, Mrs. McIntosh, a widow woman now, living in Fort Crow, she has a place for sale. I think Green and Bump of Hillsboro or Fort Crow, they have it listed. Yeah, there's a man here just a few days ago to look at it, and I was telling you before, a fellow went up the hill looking for that place up there a few days ago. Yeah, there's a place where our old schoolhouse used to be up the road here a quarter of a mile, and the man who owned it, I guess bought it for taxes or got it for almost nothing, only 2 acres, hardly 2 acres. That man Coberstein who bought it, sold it for $2,200 well, at least 10 years ago. Now, I understand it has been sold since then. And this man who is here, Mr. Blackman, who is my neighbor up the road here about a mile, he was interested in it, and he says, I would pay $6,000 for that, but it's less than 2 acres a little bit, and he says, you've got to have 2 acres or they won't allow you to have a septic tank unless you have 2 acres of land. Well, he didn't buy it.
You must be quite attached to this area then. Do you have any strong feelings toward the area? Do you really find this a good place to live and a scenic area?
There must be quite what you say?
I say this must be quite an attractive area to you then.
Oh yeah, well, you see, they want so much for the land. Now people will go from here and they'll say, why, if I put $10,000 into that place and then improve it with another $30,000 and build a $30,000 house on it, they'll look someplace else for property. Yeah, now, just for instance, this place is up here about a mile. That place was just a year ago, that is a year ago when I heard about it, but a pretty reliable sort of a guy. He told me, Susan Ray of Hee Haw. Susan Ray, you remember that name, that TV picture, Hee Haw? She bought that for $66,000. It's 37 acres and, well, there's really no improvement on it. About 10 acres in cultivation. Now then, she was going to start riding a trail ride camp, that's what they call it, trail ride. And this fellow says, I guess she gave up on that. Well, it would be a good place for that. The old road goes clear over to the summit of the Wolf River Highway. It's a, you know, rock road all the way, gravel road. And you can ride around here, can go up the other side of the creek, go on up to Stenson's old logging camp, I guess. So it would be a good enough place for a trail ride.
What's your feelings on people moving in here? Do you welcome them? Or?
Oh, yeah, I guess I do, of course. It doesn't make any difference to me.
But you plan on staying here anyway, however?
Yeah, I figure I might as well stay in here as long as I can get around. Or if I get to where I can't walk or something like that, why, that's a different story then.
Well, that's about all the questions that I have, unless you have something you'd like to offer in closing.
Well, I'm sorry. I should have had this thing laid out and rehearsed a time or two.
Oh, I think we in just this hour and a half, we touched upon a lot of various topics and your personal reminiscences and experiences. I think they point up a lot of the things that went on in this area and what this area was like and what growing up in this area was like 40, 50, 60 years ago. I think it's quite of a value, and I thank you.
Well,